ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal land in Sydney. Tonight, grinding to a halt, Australia's economy grew by just 0.2% last quarter. I'll ask the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, whether more cost of living relief is on the cards. Also in the United States, Super Tuesday all but locks in a rematch between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And in South Australia, Indigenous people start voting for their representatives in the state's new voice to Parliament.
We're going to have a voice direct to the Premier, to the ministers, to the CEOs, to the people that need to hear it, whether it's education, community issues, housing, health.
Thanks for your company. Australian economic growth has slowed to a crawl, with gross domestic product, or GDP, coming in at 0.2% for the final quarter of 2023. Economists say it's all by design, that the Reserve Bank wanted to slow the economy to bring down inflation, and it's working. But the battle against inflation isn't won, and the government's task of keeping downward pressure on inflation while staving off a recession just got even more complex. We'll speak to the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, about that shortly. But first, here's David Taylor.
The Australian economy is limping along, and many households are feeling the strain. Deloitte Access Economics partner, Stephen Smith.
The data released today shows that while Australia is not in a recession, many Australians are in a recession.
Bureau of Statistics figures show the Australian economy grew 0.2% in the 3 months to December. It means, at least for the next few months, Australia avoids a technical recession, which is defined as two consecutive quarters of negative growth. Economists say record levels of migration, exports to China, and government spending have propped up an otherwise sagging economy.
We've had very strong population growth in Australia over the last 12 months or so, mostly driven by migration. Without that population growth, the economy would have gone backwards by about 1% over the last 12 months. And so it's really population growth, more people in Australia spending more. That's what's propping up the economy at the moment and keeping us out of recession.
Elevated inflation, or the rising cost of living, is at the core of the problem. To bring the growth in prices back down to between 2 and 3%, the Reserve Bank has raised interest rates 13 times in an effort to slow demand in the economy. And it's working, says RBC Capital Markets chief economist Su Linong.
Interest rates have risen as inflation has remained high, household disposable incomes have been squeezed. We continue to see weakness in the consumer come through. On top of that, the dwelling sector as well, we know activity has started to weaken quite considerably in terms of construction, and business investment was also fairly tepid in the quarter. So it is an overall pretty weak picture, but we would remind everyone that that is the idea of rate hikes.
But 13 interest rate hikes have not brought rents, property and petrol prices, or insurance premiums back down to more normal levels. It's why Su Linong believes the Reserve Bank is unlikely to cut interest rates until much later in the year.
I mean, the Reserve Bank has one clear tool here in terms of interest rates, which does very much affect the demand side of the economy. That easing in demand should help temper in price increases longer term. Now, it's not going to affect, you know, each component of CPI equally, but it does help that to come down overall, which eventually we think will give them scope to lower interest rates later this year.
The government's committed to building 1.2 million homes over 5 years to ease the housing crisis. And its measures to bring relief on energy bills, according to the Bureau of Statistics, are helping to reduce inflation. But what if those stubbornly high costs of living don't fall further and higher interest rates continue to strangle the economy? Will we eventually see mass job losses and the economic dark days that come with that? Labour market expert Leonora Rees.
Don't anticipate the forecast is for unemployment to soar rapidly.
Is there a tipping point for the economy where if the economy is sluggish for too long, then unemployment does automatically ratchet up?
I think the key indicator there, is there a tipping point we just don't want to go past, is looking at long-term unemployed. We don't want people dropping out of the workforce or dropping out of employment for long periods of time, because that erosion can make it really hard for them to get back into paid employment. So I think that's the indicator to look closely at.
Deloitte's Stephen Smith isn't so confident about the outlook for job seekers.
It's early days. We do expect the unemployment rate to pick up. I agree. It's unlikely to pick up to, you know, the extent which would, you know, trigger a broader economic crisis. The labour market is still relatively healthy, but the slowdown is coming, and the fact that interest rates continue to rise right up into November last year means that there's still that effect to take hold through 2024.
That's Deloitte Access Economics partner Stephen Smith. David Taylor, our reporter there. Now, Jim Chalmers is the Federal Treasurer. He joined me earlier. Treasurer, thanks for being with us. We have avoided a recession. We've avoided negative growth, only just. But economists say we are in a per capita recession. Would we be in a period of negative growth if not for the high level of migration right now?
Well, first of all, it's not unusual for the per capita measure to go backwards. I think from memory, this measure went backwards something like six times under our predecessors. It's gone backwards the last few times in this data, and we don't lightly dismiss that, but it's not unprecedented for the per capita measure to go backwards. It is a combination of two things. Our economy is slowing in ways that we anticipated as a consequence of global economic uncertainty and higher interest rates and cost of living pressures here at home, combined with population growth, which has been relatively robust. And so that's how you get this kind of outcome, not unprecedented, but really just an illustration of the relative weakness in our economy towards the end of last year. But even weak growth in the circumstances that we find ourselves is welcome growth, because we do have all that global economic uncertainty. We do have pressures here at home. And so even slow growth is significant growth given those combination of challenges.
So just to be clear, robust population growth. We've had about 500,000 migrants come to Australia this year, and the government is trying to reduce that number. But how much has that migration saved us, if you like, from negative growth?
Well, you certainly see the impact of it in numbers like the services exports number, which shows, you know, whether it's tourism or education or in other sectors, you know, we do see some strength there. And obviously, the amount of people coming to visit us as tourists, as longer-term tourists, is obviously a key driver of that number. So it has been a factor, but not the only factor in our economy. Really, what these national accounts show is that consumption came off quite substantially, particularly for non-discretionary items that people spend their money on. That's because of higher interest rates and global economic uncertainty. On the plus side, we saw a good outcome when it comes to business investment. We saw productivity tick up a little bit. We've seen wages growing. We saw the tax take come down a little bit as well. And so overall, in aggregate, these are quite weak growth figures. They are weak in ways that we have anticipated, but there's signs of strength as well. We've got real wages growing again. We've got the budget in surplus. Unemployment's still only 4.1%. You know, we've got a lot going for us at the same time as we've got a lot coming at us from around the world.
As you say, we've got weak growth numbers today, and you've said that that shows that the balance of risk is shifting from inflation to growth. That is, if you like, that the risk of an overheating economy is diminishing, but sluggish growth is potentially emerging as a problem. Does that mean that the government will also shift from saving more, as you've done in the last few budgets, to spending more to help ease the cost of living pressures, which is still very real?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's important to acknowledge that we are nowhere near mission accomplished when it comes to inflation. You know, inflation is still the main challenge that we have in our economy, even though it's come off in quite welcome and quite encouraging ways since those very high peaks in 2022. So inflation is still the main game, but it's not the only game. We do need to recognise that growth has slowed considerably in our economy at the same time as we're getting on top of this inflation challenge. And so in our third budget in May, we will do what we did in the first couple of budgets, which is to make sure that our budget settings and our economic plan is really carefully calibrated to the economic conditions that we confront. And it is a more difficult balance to strike right now because we've got this slower growth, we've got this inflation challenge still hanging around. And so what we will try and do is to make sure at the same time as we get the budget in better nick, at the same time as we roll out cost of living relief, if we can afford to, at the same time as we lay the foundations for future growth, we need to balance those two competing pressures now, inflation as well as growth.
So what do you say to people who are hanging out for something more? You've done a lot, but something more on cost of living.
Well, I think the most important thing is that every taxpayer will get a tax cut from the 1st of July this year. And that is a $107 billion cost of living package, which represents bigger tax cuts for more people to help deal with these cost of living pressures. We've also got tens of billions of dollars of relief rolling out right now, rent assistance, cheaper medicines, electricity bill rebates and the like. All of that is important too. And if we can do something meaningful and responsible and affordable in addition to all of that in the May budget, then that's something that we will consider over the course of the next 5 or 6 weeks.
Okay, so if there is something in that space, some more cost of living relief in the May budget, at the same time as we're seeing disposable income rising with wages up and income taxes, as you say, about to come down from July, could all of that combined in the second half of this year actually delay interest rate cuts?
Well, as you know, David, I'm very reluctant to predict or preempt future movements in interest rates. I see that legitimately as the role of the Independent Reserve Bank to offer that kind of commentary. You know, certainly the markets are expecting interest rates to come off at some point, but I don't, for good reason, I don't buy into that. In terms of the fiscal position, it's been really clear to here, and it will be really clear from here, that whatever we do will be consistent with the objectives of the Independent Reserve Bank, not running at cross purposes. We have played a meaningful role in seeing inflation come off in our economy off those high peaks. It has come off quite substantially. Others have recognised the role of our responsible economic management and the way we've designed our cost of living help in getting that inflation to moderate. We don't want to get in the way of that. We want to see inflation come down further and faster. That's a key objective. That's our primary objective still, even as we manage and balance that against some of these other priorities, including making sure that our economy continues to grow.
And how important is a surplus for you now?
Well, the first one was very important, first one in 15 years. It meant we saved an absolute bomb on interest repayments, which is a good thing. And that was a good start. I would like to deliver a second one if we can. It remains to be seen whether we can, but we are definitely a chance of a second surplus, and that would be a good thing too, because we've never seen these surpluses as an end in themselves. You know, we see them as a foundation from which to make these other investments and fund our priorities and deal with some of the pressures that are coming at us. It's much easier to do that if you do that from a foundation of a stronger budget. The first surplus was a big part of that effort. A second one is in prospect, but not yet assured. But it would be a good thing if we could continue to get the budget in a much better nick. That gives us the flexibility to respond if we need to in a more substantial way if the economy turns down more than what we're anticipating.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers, thanks for being with us.
Much appreciated, David. All the best.
Jim Chalmers there, the Federal Treasurer. You're listening to PM with me, David Lipson. Don't forget, all of our programs are available live or later on the ABC Listen app. A video appearing to show two small Indigenous children crying and bound by cable ties in the WA town of Broome has sparked outrage. A man allegedly caught the kids trespassing and held them captive until police arrived, but he was instead charged with aggravated assault. It's the latest flashpoint in Broome's long-running issue with youth crime. and locals are worried about vigilantism. John Daly reports.
Don't worry, Perez is going to take care of it.
Don't try.
Hands bound and crying out for their mothers. Video has emerged on social media allegedly showing a 6-year-old Aboriginal girl and 7-year-old boy tied together with cable ties in a driveway. The 45-year-old man in the video allegedly found 3 children trespassing. One managed to leave the scene, but the man allegedly held the other 2 captive until police arrived. The confronting incident occurred in the northern WA town of Broome. Onlookers plead for the children to be untied.
Well, what if somebody tie your kids up like that?
Police Acting Assistant Commissioner for Regional WA, Rod Wild, told ABC Perth's morning program that officers responded to a reported trespass incident yesterday afternoon.
A male person, who will say is the 45-year-old male that's been charged, called the police to say that he had apprehended 3 children in the backyard. There's an allegation that they'd been damaging some property in the back of the yard and that he'd restrained the children. So police were subsequently called and attended and obviously located the children, as is in the video, that had been restrained allegedly by cable ties. And they called St John Ambulance, who attended as well and checked on the welfare of the children. So that was the initial concern, obviously, around the welfare of the children, making sure that they were okay.
The man has since been charged with 3 counts of aggravated assault. And while there are provisions within the law for a citizen's arrest, Assistant Commissioner Wild says it must be reasonable and proportionate.
If it goes outside of that, in this case, it's the basis of the charges, that it's disproportionate to what is reasonable in the circumstances. So, again, with anything around self-defence, citizen's arrest, we'll say that it needs to be reasonable, and people do need to take care when undertaking those activities.
WA Commissioner for Children and Young People, Jacqueline McGowan-Jones, says the video is confronting.
I was appalled. It would appear these are very young and small children, and they appear to be quite frightened in the circumstances. These children are only 6 and 7. They don't have the neurodevelopment to understand cause and effect and consequences and actions. And that is legally known, but it is also known neurodevelopmentally.
The incident has added to community tensions in Broome, where youth crime has been a rising issue. WA police are calling for calm as investigations continue. Broome resident and Yaru Kurrajari man Johani Mahmud says locals are frustrated and he worries people will take matters into their own hands.
Look, I think there's obviously been some tension building up over the last, I was going to say a handful of months, but it's probably fair to say a handful of years, actually. And so, you know, people are now kind of on alert because of all the activities that's been taking place. And so when something happens, now people are starting to talk about what they can do themselves, you know, by taking the matters into their own hands.
Does that concern you when you hear that talk of vigilantism?
It definitely does. You know, when we're talking about other kids that are a part of something bigger in terms of issues and much more complex, it's not for someone else to step in there and act like they have the solution, which is to potentially, you know, act as a vigilante.
Johani Mahmud says youth crime has caused a lot of division in Broome, and that needs to be addressed.
There needs to be reconciliation between Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people because of this division, and that maybe it's come from statistics, you know what I mean? Because the young mob that's causing the problems are Aboriginal, or mostly Aboriginal, whatever you want to call it, you know? So, but when things like this incident that happened with the cable tying of the young people, that doesn't help. It makes things worse. I don't see in any way that helps the bigger picture, whether if it's that incident alone or more people wanting to do things like that.
The 45-year-old man has been granted bail and will appear in court at a later date.
John Daly there. Well, it's 5 months since the defeat of the federal government's plan to enshrine an Indigenous voice to Parliament in the Constitution. And today, voting began in South Australia to elect representatives to that state's version of The Voice, with advocates saying it will give First Nations people a seat at the table. In one of the state's most remote Indigenous communities, residents hope The Voice will ensure they are listened to. Here's Angus Randall.
When early voting for South Australia's Voice to Parliament opened this morning, voter Vicky Hartman was first through the door.
For me, it means giving our community people they can talk to about real community issues, and then having real Aboriginal people talking to those that need to hear it from grassroots people.
Early voting centres have opened across South Australia today to elect the state's first Voice to Parliament. Only First Nations people can vote. They're choosing members who'll represent their region.
We're going to have a voice direct to the Premier, to the Ministers, to the CEOs, the people that need to hear it. There's, you know, a whole range of areas where we should be closing the gap, and this is our chance to be able to do it in, I think, a more meaningful approach and way.
South Australia passed legislation to bring in its voice to Parliament last year, before the national referendum. Because the SA voice was brought in by government rather than a public vote, it can be scrapped by a future government. Dr Anna Olenek is a senior lecturer at the University of Adelaide Law School.
The South Australian voice has a number of functions. It's got a role of delivering an annual report and an address to a joint sitting of Parliament. It can also provide Parliament with reports at any time on matters that are of interest to First Nations people. And there'll be an annual engagement hearing where the First Nations voice will be able to ask questions of ministers and chief executives of departments about the operations of the government.
So the idea is that it gets Indigenous voices in these rooms, in the places where these decisions are actually made.
Yeah, that's right. The voice is intended to be a representative body that's got a direct link to community. That's why it's elected, so that the government should be getting direct input from First Nations communities into policies that affect them.
The concept of a voice to Parliament at both the national and state level was inspired by the Uluru Statement from the Heart. The final structure of the national voice was never decided. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said the details would have been straightened out in the event of a successful referendum. But both share one key element. Any advice the voice representatives give is non-binding.
So there's no obligation on the government to follow the voice's views. As with the intention of the national voice, this is supposed to be a body that will make sure government is better informed, and then it will be up to government and parliament to decide what to do with that information.
More than 64% of South Australians voted against a national voice last October. For many First Nations people, it was a heavy blow. Jack Johncock is standing as a candidate to represent the West and West Coast region of SA.
Firstly, you know, I've got to sort of mention how disappointed I am with the national voice campaign and how the results from that just basically told Indigenous people that Australia don't want a voice, but To the credit of the South Australian government, you know, they've pushed it through, and I'm rapt that we in South Australia are going to be talking first down to the premiers and government in this state.
Those in SA's West say it's easy to feel disconnected from decisions made in Adelaide. Travis Nash lives in Port Lincoln on the Eyre Peninsula. He says having representatives elected by locals for locals will make a huge difference.
When it comes to stuff like this, it's always people from Adelaide or from the bigger cities. And those people have been raised, they grew up and raised in the city, and they make decisions for people in a country, and they don't know country. So it's really good to see that we're going to be having country people representing country people. The people that will be appointed is my neighbour, in a way, instead of going to Adelaide, and when I talk to people, they're in suits and expensive shoes.
Even further west is the remote Aboriginal community of Yalata, nearly 1,000 kilometres from Adelaide. Resident Timothy Muragili says there are several issues facing the town.
Housings, drainage, roads, crowded houses.
And it's difficult to find solutions when decisions are made so far away.
People that live in community and see what happens out on community got a more perspective of what happens in community.
That's echoed by fellow resident Russell Bryant, who hopes the voice will be a force for good.
We can work together, but they need to listen to us. We're living here, they not. They only come and go. We want them to listen to us And that way we can work together as a family.
Polling closes on Saturday, March 16. The SA Electoral Commission expects results will be announced from March 25.
Angus Randall and Stephanie Richards there. To the United States now, where Donald Trump has all but seized the Republican nomination after a thumping result on the biggest day of the US presidential primary season, Super Tuesday. It means a rematch of the 2020 election between two deeply unpopular candidates will almost certainly happen in November. So how do American voters feel about more of the same? Stephanie Smale takes a look.
There were lines around the block at some voting centres in the Texas city of Houston, and some locals weren't happy to hear the current president and his predecessor are now even more likely to be the Democratic and Republican candidates.
It's just disgraceful. We don't need two octogenarians running for office. There's plenty of other people who are earlier in their careers who could run and do a better job than those two.
Very disappointed. I wish there were two better options.
Millions of voters in 15 states and one American territory cast their ballots on Super Tuesday to help choose who will be their party's presidential nominee in the November election. Joe Biden won unchallenged in every location. In the Republican contest, Nikki Haley won in Vermont, but Donald Trump won the rest.
They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one.
Although the results aren't surprising, Donald Trump celebrated with supporters at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, taking a swipe at Joe Biden.
We've watched our country take a great beating over the last 3 years, and nobody thought a thing like this would be possible. He's the worst president in the history of our country.
Joe Biden has released a statement saying Trump is focused on revenge and retribution rather than the American people. Victoria Cooper is a research editor at the United States Studies Center. She says Super Tuesday is essentially like a pre-selection contest for political seats in Australia, and it's usually hyper-competitive.
But this year has been so dissatisfyingly boring in that Donald Trump and Biden are so clearly the front runners, and both of their primaries have failed to be even a little bit competitive.
Although Biden and Trump are already campaigning like it's official, it won't be until mid-year. The Super Tuesday results for Trump's only remaining opponent, Nikki Haley, aren't great, and Victoria Cooper says the race could be over for her.
There is immense pressure for Nikki Haley, who is the last sort of candidate in Trump's way, to just end it, call it quits, to finish her campaign and just let the inevitable happen. And perhaps after today, we'll see that result happening.
California was an important state for both Trump and Biden, and they both won their party's primaries in that state. Biden supporter and musician Frank Basile cast his ballot beachside in Los Angeles.
It's like, get in there and get those votes happening because I don't want Trump to be president again.
Retired art director Kirk was there too, and he's hoping Trump will mend the economy.
You walk into any major commercial center in New York and all these other places in the United States, and they're just for rent, for rent, for rent, for rent. I mean, all over the place. And under Trump, it was kicking butt, man. It was going forward full steam ahead.
That sentiment was echoed with this voter about 2,000 kilometres east in Colorado.
I was making money. I was living. I was able to freaking make it. I'm struggling now, and I make good money, and I don't want to be struggling anymore.
Back in Houston, this former Republican supporter says the way Trump handled COVID hasn't been forgotten.
It hurts my soul to say that I will vote for Joe Biden over Donald Trump. He acted like it wasn't a big deal. My dad died of it from Republican politics. It's just unconscionable.
So what other big issues are driving support for the Democrats or the Republicans? Washington Post columnist and Brookings Institution senior fellow E.J. Dion says the Democrats have lost working class voters to the Republicans.
That is the paradox of class in our politics. Historically, the Republicans were the party of the upper class, including the educated class, Democrats of the working class, and now it's the other way around.
E.J. Dion, who's also a professor at Georgetown University, says Trump's divisive approach has driven some out of the Republican Party altogether. But he explains those that remain are passionate.
There is a a degree of, I'll use the word fanatical, devotion to Trump that's not like anything we've seen very often in our politics.
William Sabatini, who voted in Nashville, Tennessee, says Trump has his support.
He's not the Lord and Savior, that's Jesus Christ, but I feel personally that he is the direction this country needs to go into.
Other voters are over it all already.
I'm looking to go to Canada or Paris. Any French women who can speak the language want to put up with a six-foot giant?
Stephanie smiled with that report. That's the program for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. And of course, Sabra Lane will be up early with AM in the morning. Until then, good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For more than 20 years, Australians have turned to Botox when unwanted wrinkles begin to emerge. So why have regulators decided to crack down on it now? Today we speak to a long-time Botox user and a health law expert about why we need to rethink what we're injecting. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.